This is Lest We Forget, Lest We Forget, Sustaining Memory in Postcolonial Archives. I am Bert Lyons. I'm from the Association for Cultural Equity in New York, which is also affectionately known as the Alan Lomax Archive, sometimes not affectionately known as that. There's a great lineup today. I'm honored and excited to be on this panel with Gail Williams, to my left, from Florida International University, and Helen Wong Smith from the University of Hawaii, both extremely accomplished professionals in their field, and I'm very excited about their presentations today. I do want to mention that this session is sponsored by the Latin American and Caribbean Cultural Heritage Archives Roundtable, one of the longest names for a roundtable, I think. and I'd also like to say, since there's three of us and we have very limited time, if you could just hold all of the questions. I know there's going to be 100 or at least 200 questions. Just hold them until the end, and we'll get to them. We're going to try to get through our presentations pretty quickly so we can have some discussion, if possible. I will mention briefly, Helen Wong Smith will explore the complex of museums, libraries, archives, and historical societies that sustain and support Hawaiian cultural memory. Gail is going to reveal the efforts of DLOC, which is the Digital Library of the Caribbean, which is a program dedicated to open access and preservation of Caribbean information resources. I'm going to get us started, though, and I'm going to talk about a Caribbean repatriation project that we have at the Alan Lomax Archive, where we take the digitized recordings from Lomax's collections and return them to different islands and different communities. So let me get us started here. I will say that in 1962 and 1963, Alan Lomax, who's a folklorist and ethnomusicologist, with the help of Jacob D. Elder, who's a Caribbean scholar, and the University of the West Indies, and lots of local informants throughout the Caribbean islands, he completed what became a pan-Caribbean effort to document musics, dances, and other traditions of many Caribbean cultures. The documentary materials of his collection represent one of the earliest comprehensive collections of field recordings, of sound recordings from the Caribbean region. And although Lomax did leave copies at the University of the West Indies when he was finished, the originals went back with him to New York City, as many original recordings did by researchers and scholars in the areas during those times. And so these recordings that Lomax collected in 62 and 63 are what are going to be the foundation, what became the foundation for our archival repatriation project, and they're the focal point around which this discussion will take place, although they're not the only collections at the Lomax Archive. Real quick, the Association for Cultural Equity is the Alan Lomax Archive. It maintains Alan's intellectual legacy, all of his recordings, field recordings, photographs, documentary materials, videos, films, just all kinds of things. It was established by Alan as a registered charity and as an activist archive back in the 1980s. And after Alan's death and his retirement first and then his death, we began to organize and identify the collections and began a digitization program. And in 2005, we transferred the materials to the Library of Congress at the American Folklife Center, the originals. It was a long process of disposition. It took about 3 years. But now the Association for Cultural Equity is in a very interesting situation, a transitional archive with a digital-only collection. So we once had a physical collection. We did a lot of preservation work on the collection and then transferred it to a larger repository, which allows us to be creative and flexible with how we deal with our now digital-only collection, which we still maintain the authority to publish and disseminate as part of the relationship between the Lomax Archive and the Library of Congress. I will say that that's the AFC I was going to show you. I forgot about that. The extent of the collection is I spelled it out briefly because I don't want to get in too much into the details of the collection, but it's a fairly large collection. The Caribbean materials represent about 300 hours of sound recordings and over 1,000 documentary photographs. And briefly, I will run you through Lomax's work in the Caribbean. In 1937, he recorded in Haiti. In 1935, he was in the Bahamas. And I told you in 62 through 63, he was throughout the West Indies. And then in 67, he returned to the Dominican Republic and St. Eustatius for a brief trip. Quite a lot of representation of a lot. He didn't obviously reach everything, but quite a bit. And I also will. I have some photographs throughout the presentation, just so you can see some of the photographs, some of the musics that were being recorded. There are two guiding principles that underline our repatriation project, and I just want to share them with you because they're important for why we do what we do. And the first is called cultural equity, which was Alan Lomax's belief that the expressive traditions of all local and ethnic cultures should be valued equally as representative of the multiple forms of human adaptation on Earth. And for Alan, it was also a belief that all cultures should have equal time in educational settings and in mass communication systems. And so at the Association for Cultural Equity, our mission is served through, we repatriate publishing rights and royalties to performers from the publications that have already been put out over the years, and we disseminate the archives through the internet, and then we also return field recordings and photographs and other documentation to the regions of their origin. The second principle is called cultural feedback, which is an idea that was championed early by a number of folklorists, including Alan Lomax, that folklore and primary documentation of culture should be put into the hands of the original cultural creators. I don't want to continue reading that, but rather than remain the sole province of scholars. And basically what that means is, you know, all of these wonderful recordings of cultural heritage from around the world end up in repositories, and they end up in you know, various large nations with lots of power, and the people and the cultures that they represent typically are very, very far from those locations. So the concept is that the music and the traditions do more power closer to the people who from where they came, that they have more strength. And so, for example, on Lomax's recording trips to the Caribbean in the 60s, he carried stereo speakers on the plane with him and took them to every recording locale where he was, and he made it a practice to play back the music to whoever he was recording after it was done, because it was his whole concept was to combat mass communication, this gray out of popular culture that takes place with radio, and where there's very few people have transmitters and everybody has receivers. And so his idea was, well, here's an opportunity to add to the transmitters and let people who don't usually get to be heard be heard. So we take this, there's a photograph of Alan in playing back music in the Caribbean. We follow in Alan's footsteps with our repatriation program by returning digital copies of these recordings and photographs in our collection to the places and people nearest the original creation. Since 2005, we've been doing this work with the Center for Black Music Research at Columbia College in Chicago. They're a partner to help make contacts with repositories in the Caribbean, so that we're not just going down there blindly and giving things back to institutions that might not be able to handle it or might not be interested in it, so that we're actually developing positive partnerships and collaborations. Here's some more photographs. This process, and what's interesting about this process is that we propose it as a model for and a means of stimulating similar initiatives by other small archives and researchers. Our ultimate goal, however, is to pave the way for these for Caribbean countries and cultures to come into full possession of all the available documentation of their cultural traditions. A development that made it possible for us to imagine this repatriation project is that we succeeded to digitize the collections, right? Including the extent of all of the Caribbean recordings. We started this in 1998, and over the course of 4 years, we completed digitizing all the sound recordings. These are tapes from Lomax's collections, and he would keep notes which we were able to use to create our catalogs and establish all the metadata support for the digital recordings that we created. And through this work, we realized that we could create first an online database, which was the first iteration of our database, which we launched in 2003, and it's gone through a few changes. We created a Google Earth layer, and to try to reach a different audience, we've got a very new, sleek interface, which has just now come out. And it provides access to all the digitized sound recordings in the collection, and photographs. But the point, the reason I'm talking about the databases is that I think that the online access is really a passive way of sharing information with people. It's there. We put it up there. People can come to it, but there's no really collaborative interaction. And so what we do with the repatriation project is what we see as our active method of dissemination with other archives, libraries, cultural repositories, and sometimes just strictly with communities and individuals, which allows us to put these recordings in many places, to proliferate, which digital recordings allow us to do. So those are the components of the repatriation project. It's very simple. We have already completed the digital transfers. We have electronic catalogs. Those have become the foundation for not only online access but also direct delivery. And the reasons are many why it makes sense to deliver it digitally instead of to give back original analog tapes. Mostly because the institutions that we're working with don't want the tapes. They can't do anything with them. And they become more of a burden than anything useful. The digital collections allow us, as I said, to proliferate, to place them in many places. We can place the same recording in as many places as is interested in having it, which also allows us to maintain a collaborative relationship with a repository to handle any kind of future accessibility issues that may come up with the technology. Quick, just rundown of the steps. We do invite collaborations. We don't just send things to people. We want to develop a relationship, so we invite collaborations with the repositories. There is an agreement of deposit as part of it, there's no fees. There's no fees or anything like that. But there is the recognition that the materials will be used for open access, public access, and non-commercial uses. Just to protect the people who are on the recording, so there is a signed aspect to that. We do coordinate the deliveries, and then most importantly, we maintain contact with repositories regarding accessibility of the collections. So originally, we thought it would be pretty simple. We would do what I've talked about, and then we would just deliver a standard digital package to each repository. But what has become the working model and what makes a lot of sense after having completed a number of these projects is to capture the materials, to create partnerships, and then to assess the technological compatibility level for each repository, because some repositories may want CDs, we thought we would just give everybody hard drives with everything on it and they could download, but of course that's not the best way that we've found to approach it. So we do whatever the repository wants, because we don't see this as a preservation project, but as a dissemination, a repatriation project. So if the repository wants a paper copy of the catalog, we give them a paper copy of the catalog, because we have all of the digital, and we have everything backed up, and we maintain any kind of we keep things current. And so we can always redeliver if an institution gets to the point where, okay, well, we no longer need the CDs. It would be really great if you could just send us a hard drive now, or put it on a hard drive so we don't have to go through CD by CD and import. So that's part of the collaborative relationships with the repositories. But we also work with the repositories to then go further and say, well, now that these materials are here, they can be used for outreach purposes on radio, in schools, that these materials can live on, and help coordinate and be a support. It's been very flexible. We've completed three dissemination projects so far in the Caribbean. One at the Nevis and St. Kitts Historical Society, they now have all the Nevis and St. Kitts recordings that we've had. One at the Folk Research Center in St. Lucia. And most recently at La Mediatek Caribe in Guadeloupe. We have more planned in Trinidad and Tobago, Carriacou, and Haiti are upcoming projects in the next couple of years. But so far it's been working out very well. How much time do I have left? Does anybody? Okay. So I'm at the end of my presentation. I just wanted to be quick and give you a rundown, but I will share, since I have time, if this works, some music. Let's see if we can get some volume going. Well, that's okay. This was just going to be a special treat anyway. I'm not going to waste too much time with it. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our next speaker. Helen Wong-Smith, unless you'd like to go, Gail. She is currently the Hawaiian Collection Librarian and Archivist at the University of Hawaii, Hilo. She's worked with Hawaiian Archival Collections since her early 1980s. Her experience in private community and academic collections as an employee and consultant provides her with knowledge of diverse collections. She's a two-time past president of the Association of Hawaii Archivists, and she recently received their Agnes C. Conrad Award, which is affectionately referred to as the Aggie, for service to the archival profession.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Aloha kakahiaka. For those of you who came out so darn early to attend this session, I'm happy to offer private tours to Volcano National Park when you come to Hawaii. Okay? All right. That's the least I can do for you. And Ken Burns' new documentary is coming out this fall on the national park system, and Volcano is proudly represented. So hopefully that'll whet your appetite. How do you go ahead? Yay! Okay, I'm not going to read timelines to you. I'm not going to read this, but I just want it up there so that you realize that Hawaii did experience five different governments. We were never officially a colony by political mandate, but we certainly have been colonized, let me assure you. Remember that upon Captain Cook's arrival in 1778, that we are the most isolated piece of land in the world. We are the archipelago in the world, and that there had been no outside contact for a good 500 years. We had an oral tradition, so no written language or such, and it was passed down through stories and chants and songs. And like the Greeks, you know, that incredible memory that would go far, far back and be able to recite 30 generations of your family. Wish I had that kind of memory. But when the missionaries came in 1820, their how do I get rid of it?
No, just go up and it's got an X on it. Just go up to the top. And, oh, the very top. And oh, get rid of it.
There's
that one.
That one? Okay, yeah. I can't see it on the screen. That's
oh,
one.
Sorry.
Okay. Yay. Okay. So. So you see them coming in 1820, and just the very fact that these missionaries came from my favorite acronym, the ABCFM, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, that began our colonization with America. These missionaries from Yale came over, and they were They were very smart. They hit the royalty first. They convinced the royalty that you need to adopt Jesus into your life, our Jesus, not anybody else's version, and that we're going to teach you all how to read and write. So they did that. The reason I'm going to be putting on several The reason I'm putting down different treaties is to show that we were an independent, we were a sovereign nation, and we had these official collaborations and treaties with other countries. It's not like we were just kind of, you know, happy natives running around and singing and dancing. I mean, the fact that we had a constitution as of 1840 and such. So these are the types of political activities that showed. Now, good old Lord Paulet came in 1843 and took over the islands. And because of this, and you'll see on my next slide, that good old Admiral Thomas came over and said, no, we're not taking over this country, and restored sovereignty to the islands. This brought on the need for a constitution. You can see the secret agreement with the United States, but a constitution that was then enacted, and this is huge, that allowed for private land ownerships. The Hawaiian concept is that you would all land is held in trust. It was not a feudal society, but all land is held in trust by the royalty. And then there was a hierarchy of how this land management worked. But because of this takeover, being held hostage by Paulet for a few years, this scared the royalty. And so the American missionary advisors to the king said, you really got to put in a fee simple way of managing. And this was a huge cultural shift to the native populations. They was like, what do you mean I have to go out and claim this piece of land for myself? I mean, no, it belongs to my king. I am here at his service. He takes care of me. So it was a very difficult, it was a huge cultural shift for the Hawaiians. Then as we got further and further, I'm highlighting the five governments for you. That's why they're bolded. We had the kingdom, the provisional government, the republic, the territory, and then the statehood. So this is why, without reading everything out to you, this was a huge cultural shift as far as the land tenure ideal went. And so that was just the beginning of a political, governmental, and cultural shift. So people don't realize that Hawaii was truly overthrown, and when the queen tried to restore the throne powers, I mean, they really did. It was gunboat diplomacy. There truly was an American man of war in the harbor, and the missionary descendants. You've heard the old adage that the missionaries came to Hawaii to do good, and they did very well. So they said, okay, you know, we're going to fire upon your people if you don't abdicate right now. So she did so to prevent bloodshed. And President Cleveland heard about this and said, what's going on out there? And he did send out a gentleman named Blount, who said, came out to the islands and explored things and said, yeah, this was illegal. We didn't, you know, the United States did not authorize this. And he was an anti-imperialist, and he withdrew the treaty negotiated by Harrison that had occurred previously. But then President McKinley came into office, and McKinley was all about Hawaii, the Philippines, and such. And so our chances of regaining independence or retaking back our sovereignty was gone, gone, gone. So finally, the queen does abdicate the throne, pledging allegiance to the republic. At this time, there was a provisional government. And it was interesting because the person who was the president of the provisional government and the republic was Sanford B. Dole. It's okay to have Dole pineapple. It wasn't, you know, the man who started Dole pineapple. It was just the cousin. But anyway, so so by this time, President McKinley signs the Organic Act, making us a territory. And then we waited 59 years before we could become a state. And right now we are celebrating, this year we're celebrating our 50th anniversary as a state. Mind you that this is not a very popular thing with the entire populace of the state of Hawaii, because many people feel that we were illegally overthrown and therefore we should be going back to of sovereign nation. So the thing that we have here is just some of the things that got us to be the 50th state, but it was a long time. And talking to Marisol last night about how Puerto Rico is debating with the, you know, remaining as a territory, becoming a statehood, it's like, take a lesson from Hawaii. Once you become a state, you can't go back. So it's really, really hard, as vocal as many people are in the islands about that. Now, I wanted to show you, when you consider that, when big agriculture, you know, you had the subsistence lifestyle, you had these individual parcels in the traditional land tenure and management paradigm, that when you had, and they said, wow, stuff grows really nicely on this soil. I mean, this is, as Mark Twain said, the most beautiful chain of islands that he had, emerald islands that he had ever experienced. And so large-scale agriculture came in. You had your pineapple, you had your sugar, the things that we're accustomed to relating to Hawaii. And the Hawaiian population was being disseminated. You've been isolated for over 500 years, and a common cold. The measles wiped out tens of thousands of Hawaiians. First, of course, came VD, and so with the sailors and the whalers. But then you have a population, a native population, that is just decimated. And so we had to bring in people from other countries to work on these large-scale plantations. So that was started off with the Chinese and then the Japanese and Koreans and Filipinos and what have you. So that is one of the reasons we are such a diverse population in the islands. And the intermarrying, we've always led the nation as far as intermarriage. I'm a product of Chinese and Portuguese saying, yeah, what the heck, let's get married. Or as my mother says, Chinese will marry anybody. So so she's the Portuguese, as you can tell. So in order to capture that, to capture the cultural heritage of each of these ethnicities, when the different groups, you would have literally separate camps. You would have the Chinese camp, the Portuguese camp, and what have you. Where did they all get together? In school. All the children went to school, and it was, you know, fine to intermarry because they grew up together. But we do work very, very hard to retain that ethnic identity. And so, for instance, at the plantation village, if you click on any of the individual sites, they will have a short a bio, and then you have camps. You know, you have different camps. This is the Chinese village. This is what a Chinese house would look like. This is the Japanese furo, the bathing house, and the community bathing house and such. So it's very, it's retained. It truly is retained. And that's just one small portion of what happens when you have such a diverse ethnicity living in an extremely small place. So small archives in Hawaii have been the keepers of local history and hold much of the collective memory in the community. Combined with larger archival institutions, they provide a rich insight to each island and the cultural diversity of its citizens. Each each institution reflects a strong sense of place and community. You would think that being such a small state that it would be homogeneous in the sense of like, okay, well, let's, you know, just focus on the history of sugar or the history of missionaries or something like that. But no, we're as small as we are, place-based information and place-based memory is extremely important. I have here Hana Cultural Center. They focus a lot more on the Hawaiian aspect of things. And here's your traditional Hawaiian sleeping house. And then here is from Hana Lei on Kauai. And by the way, when he wrote Puff the Magic Dragon, you know Hana Lei, he meant Hana Lei. He had been to Hana Lei, and he said, okay, if I say Hana Lei in the song, everybody will come here and ruin this place. So it's called Hana Lei. Little bit of useless factoid for you. Anyway, so this is the missionary home there. And missionary history is still accepted and very big, and because they had such a pivotal role in our history. So now, when I say large institutions, this is Hawaii's oldest and largest museum. And it was founded in 1889. And through the years, they have grown to include millions of artifacts, documents, journals, manuscripts, books, newspapers, photographs, and plant specimens. We are very big on natural history because we got more endemic and biota than anybody else. Ha. And besides the fact that, you know, when you're isolated for that long, things tend to evolve into its own species. So including artwork and films and many other items, that it is one of the most important museums in the Pacific region. And so the Bishop Museum does an excellent job of retaining that memory and providing it. This ethnology database is just a small portion of the holdings and their efforts to make accessible the information that is there. I don't know that you can see this very well, but the Hawaii Historical Society was founded in 1892. So you see this trend that that as small as we are, as many conflicting interests that you might have in a very small place, is the fact that people very early on were saying, oh my God, things are changing too fast. We have got to retain our history. And so you have the Bishop Museum and Hawaiian Historical Society all starting in the 19th century. The Historical Society, it has just this fabulous array on their website, and I highly encourage you, because if nothing else, the entertainment value. But these are Hawaii history moments, and even things like when ice cream was introduced into the islands, or when beauty contests. I mean, the things as serious as disasters of 1944, or when FDR visited during the Depression and such. So they're extremely diverse collections. Now, during the territorial years, several important historical repositories were founded, including the first public archives, that is now the state archives, in the nation. Ours was founded in 1906. Does anybody know if your state archives was founded prior to that? Okay. gotcha. So this is one of the, this is just some of the things that you'll find at the state archives, which I think is fabulous. Sanborn fire maps. Anybody have those? Oh God, don't you love them? They're hand colored. I mean, they're just so exciting. So yes, we did have towns that warranted fire insurance. And so therefore we have, our fire insurance maps. And so, then you have what I thought was just fabulous. Some of the, placards and things that, are available, the commercial labels. I just think that's hilarious. Another one, okay, so the missionaries had such an impact in our collection. The descendants of have started the Hawaiian Missions Children's Society that was founded in 1922, and it specializes in material of the American Protestant missionaries and their descendants, as many of them are still very important people in our business community. So those things are all available for the general populace to explore our history. This is at the University of Hawaii. You see that we have the plantation archives, and this is extremely useful because think about it. You have Ellis Island on the continent here. Well, when the different ethnicities came in and to work on the plantations, many of them came with a contract. It was contract labor, and so with the intention of going home, and many did not. And so when they would come in, and in the Japanese case, you know, send home to Japan for picture brides, for the Chinese, marry the Hawaiians and anybody, and get some land, or the Filipinos. And now the generation, subsequent generations are saying, I think I know my great-grandfather's name. And so the plantation archives have the employee records. They have various materials. So they are a very rich collection of manuscripts and company records that are hugely beneficial for people nowadays. So this is just one of the collections that we have that we've done. World War II depository. My colleague Jim Cartwright, the university archivist there, is responsible for this collection. And, you know, we have everything from, after all, we did have the joy of Pearl Harbor. So we have a lot of photos and documents regarding World War II, and this was an air raid practice, and they're helping a blind vendor across the street. Our national park, as I earlier touted, was established in the 1920s, and so we have collections at the Hawaii Volcano National Park, and they do have their own archives as well. I included this one as part of the War Records Depository at UH because the children were encouraged to wear bunny masks, and so you make the hood a little less intimidating. They put bunny ears on the masks, and that was supposed to prevent them from being gassed out. But you'll notice that the bottom is just a little pool tie. Yeah, that's really going to do it. So some of the information, some of the repositories that are out there that show not only the ethnic diversity, but they will focus on industry, as you saw earlier, by geographical area and such. So the Kona Coffee Living History Farm, you go there and like Williamsburg or something, you know, you see what it was like to be there. Then ethnicity, the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii. We have the Pacific Tsunami Museum because in Hilo, because we have been hit by two catastrophic tsunamis. And then this is, what is this? Oh, that's mine. Okay. All right. The Hawaii Medical Library had hired me to start off what we call the Mamiya Medical Heritage Center, and by Dr. Mamiya, who was the foremost heart surgeon in the country, and he wanted to retain the history of medicine practices in Hawaii. Now, I bring this is just one small portion of it, but, you know, since Hawaii was the place to be. People had the wanderlust and such, and people came and went, and many of them are physicians that served in Hawaii for a couple years, or some stayed forever. And my friend there is Ann Katz, and she was a pathologist at our hospital that just celebrated 150 years. And I mentioned to somebody, I said, she's been here since 1959. And he said, wow, she's really sick, huh? So anyway, So the oral histories, I would get inquiries all over the country and the world saying, oh, you know, my great-granduncle served in Hawaii for a couple years in the 40s. You know, do you have anything on him? And yes, we do. We retain those records. So it's quite interesting. I just want to show you that the Hawaii State Archives is very aggressively providing a lot of our resources online now with our digital collections. And this is a vital statistics. Now, in the old days, because we were a kingdom and not a, you know, didn't have U.S. census, it was the missionaries that took the census to show that they were doing really good work and making us all good Christians. And so, for instance, they're the ones that did it, the census. And so this is actually a handwritten Hawaiian marriage certificate from 1845. Now, imagine the power of discovering this type of information. Index to passenger manifests. I mentioned that, you know, so many of the people had to come through. And so even if it's digitizing the typewritten card catalog from the, you know, it's still very powerful for people to discover this. So this is a very popular thing. This is one of my favorites. This is from my island. And it's all in Hawaiian, and it does get down to the name, how many horses they had, and such. So it's a fabulous discovery tool that people just get so excited when they see this. I mentioned the decimation of the population, the horrible history of Kalaupapa, which is now a national park site, and the leper colony down there. And so this is, since Father Damon will be feted this October, and the records down there are very important too. So we have so many different facets to capture, as everyone does, but in the microcosm of these small little islands. And so this is just a tiny portion of what we have to offer and the efforts that we're trying to make to retain our rich history. Mahalo. Okay, I get the honor of introducing Gail Williams, who has been the Latin American Caribbean Information Services Librarian co-director of Digital Library of the Caribbean since September 2007. Don't let that fool you. She's been doing this forever. She has worked with Latin American and Caribbean materials since 1978. There you go. And as an active member, plus past president, of the seminar on the acquisition of Latin American library materials, she received an MLS for the University of Texas at Austin. So I wish I had met her earlier this week because she could tell me where to go. And an MA in Latin American Studies from the University of New Mexico. So it's my pleasure to introduce Gail Williams.
Thank you, and good morning. And I do appreciate an early morning audience. 8 a.m. is never easy. I'd also like to express my appreciation to Marisol Ramos and Susan Lugo for putting this panel together and accepting my proposal to participate. So you're all getting a little info card we put together. It has the URL for www.dloc.com. So the Digital Library of the Caribbean, and we are multilingual, so it's also La Biblioteca Digital del Caribe and La Bibliothèque Numérique du Caribe. And I actually, now that we have an Aruban partner, I'm going to need to learn how to say that in Dutch. And henceforth, DLOC is the acronym that we do use to talk about ourselves. So that it's quicker to say than Digital Library of the Caribbean, every instance. Okay. Well, the Digital Library of the Caribbean was born, in 2005 with a grant awarded from the U.S. Department of Education's Technological Innovation and Cooperation for Foreign Information Access, otherwise known by the lovely acronym of TICFIA. This is a program that's been in existence since the year 2000, and the objective is for U.S. institutions, whether they're libraries or in some cases research institutes or archives, to partner with foreign members to help them or put together projects that do have a foreign partner and helping them make whatever their information is available. This process got started by my predecessor with some initial work she had done with the St. Croix campus of the University of the Virgin Islands, also, and then with her own meeting and talking to librarians and archivists in the Caribbean, where everyone saw the need, that they knew the technology was there as far as digitizing and putting together online libraries of digital information. Boy, this thing just keeps coming back. So DLOC was created with planning, and essentially we are a very multifaceted project, and our principles are using a model of collaboration to provide open access for unique and important research materials from throughout the Caribbean. So what that means is we do have U.S. partners and Caribbean partners. Florida International University, my role again is coordinator. Our grant pays for a full-time project coordinator who really does most of the daily groundwork. I'm co-director with Judith Rogers, who is the head librarian at UVI St. Croix. She and I come in with policy questions, helping to promote the project, looking at new partner identification, and so on. And then in my role, I do daily supervision of my fantastic grant coordinator. The University of Florida is the technical side of our grant. Their Digital Library Center of the UF Libraries is the one that created the database itself for DLOC, also created the tool that partners use to add their content to DLOC, and we call it simply the DLOC Toolkit. The background is our original founding partners were the National Archives of Haiti, the Fundación Global Democracia y Desarrollo in Santo Domingo, and that's an NGO that's run by Leonel Fernandez, the current president of the Dominican Republic, the National Library of Jamaica, the Universidad de Oriente, the University of the East in Cumaná, Venezuela, CARICOM, and the University of the Virgin Islands. We also, again, our U.S. partners are Florida International University, the University of Florida, and the University of Central Florida. So in essence, how this really works is our UF partners at the Digital Library Center provide training and coordination and the technical infrastructure of the database. We provide the grant allowed us to provide equipment to the initial partners, and then because we had two big personnel shifts after the second year of the grant, mainly again my predecessor leaving, my arriving, the first grant coordinator hired was gone by the time I got there, so we had several months' salary savings when my new coordinator came in. So that's actually allowed us to stretch our money and bring in additional partners and do lots more training trips. The training trips, we contact the original partners, schedule that. The trainers from UF go down. But at the partner library, again, the idea of collaboration is to start it and make it kind of a ripple effect. So it isn't necessarily just the sole partner getting the training. They are invited to also invite any other local libraries or archives who might have interest or the potential to become a DLOC partner to also sit in at least on the initial training, which is the demo. And again, for the collaboration and the idea of open access is that the DLOC toolkit, and simply a software program, it goes a little more beyond just the regular scanning and OCR text recognition of the materials going in to DLOC. What it's also doing is it creates that image, but twofold, so that the one image is then goes by file transfer protocol, FTP, to the UF server. But it also creates the same image that the partner site, whether it's in Haiti or Jamaica or the Bahamas, one of our newer partners, can also keep and retain. So the idea is that we only ask that we can have that we have non-exclusive rights to whatever it is they're contributing into DLOC. Partners are responsible in the case of materials that are still in copyright. It's up to them to go out and get copyright permissions and clearance for material like that. And so far, we have not had any angry letters from anyone saying, take that off your site. So I think that's good news. So again, though, the idea is that even though an item might be downloaded into DLOC, the partner library that has possession of it is free to take that digitized material and do anything else with it that they think is appropriate or would be useful. So our project is not, it's not really repatriation. You know, we really look at it as being, digital preservation and conservation, taking into mind, of course, you know, living in Miami, Florida, you know, we're now in hurricane season, and having lived in the Caribbean, I can tell you it's a very serious issue to deal with. And again, the other part of it is just as Helen was telling us about how Hawaii has actually been through several iterations of different government structures. The Caribbean, even today, is still a real mix of independent nations. But also bear in mind, our own country is still a colonial power. With Puerto Rico as a commonwealth and the U.S. Virgin Islands as a territory. And in the same way, Great Britain still has a commonwealth link to many of the smaller islands there as well. Guadeloupe and Martinique are overseas provinces of France, and so on. If you really go into DLOC, what you'll find you might consider not necessarily a balanced, perfect representation of Caribbean material. But again, that goes back to the collaborative model. It's up to our partners to decide what it is from their collection that they're going to add to DLOC. The National Archives of Haiti initially put in a very large number, but a great collection of 19th century photographs of various kinds of shots around the island of older buildings, some of which are no longer there today. And some people said, well, we'd really like to see something else besides just photos coming out from them. But we said, you know, it's up to them to decide that. But they are now starting to look at bringing out a lot of what are going to be primary source documents from the archives as well. So this is exciting. The National Library of Jamaica, we've been working with, and I had a great meeting with the director when I was in Kingston in June. They've had some of our members, if they have staff turnovers, we've had a lull in activity, and we do work with them at least to say, hi, is everything all right? She's had a staff turnover, but we were discussing her ideas on some of the things that they plan to be adding to the collection in the future. CARICOM, which is an economic integration group, for lack of a better description, the librarian there has been working. She's concentrated primarily on documents from Cara Festa, which is an annual Caribbean drama event, and there are some fascinating things in there. Other people are telling us, we'd like to see the other stuff CARICOM has. We keep saying, well, but that's up to them to make that decision. And we do pass that along. At ACURIL, the Association of Caribbean University Research and Institutional Libraries, we have an executive committee meeting with our partner members. At the Caribbean Studies Association meeting, we also have a meeting with our advisory board, which consists of scholars who are engaging in work on the Caribbean, so that we get lots of ideas from as many sources as we can. I will briefly mention our partners from the Caribbean have increased again with salary savings. We were able to start doing much more training because this is our fourth and five. Actually, we're coming into the last month of the grant for the last 4 years. And in the just barely year and a half, we've also added the College of the Bahamas, the Christian Brothers of Haiti, the National Library of Aruba, the Belize National Library Service and Information Systems, the Pontificia Universidad Católica Madre Maestra from Santo Domingo, that is the Pontificial Catholic University, Madre Maestra, Widecast, the Wider Caribbean Sea Turtle Conservation Network, University of South Florida, even the FIU College of Law Library. We just were very interested in working with me with some Cuban materials that they have. And we do keep seeking out different partners in different places. We were also talking in Jamaica with the Center for Caribbean Thought at the University of the West Indies there. They have some upcoming collections donated to them from Gordon K. Lewis, one of the leading Latin American Caribbean historians, and someone else whose names escape me. But they're just barely in the process of opening and processing those archives, but that would be an exciting component to come in. We are probably getting close to bringing in the University of Puerto Rico Library, and I'll get to the reason why in just a minute. We're still working with anyone and everyone. The Caribbean is not just the islands in terms of our scope. It includes anywhere that has a coast touching the Caribbean. So I recently had a conversation with someone from Nicaragua who will probably be joining us over the next year, which is really gratifying. The exciting news I have is that we have the opportunity to reapply for a TICFIA grant, but you don't get renewed just because you've done the job good. The new grant calls for taking a project in a new direction, bringing in something very different. We submitted our proposal this spring and decided to focus our efforts on Caribbean newspapers, because from my experience is older newspapers vary widely in what holdings people have for them, whether it's in paper or microfilm. And this is a frequently asked question. And we also discovered that a lot of our original partners who do keep newspapers in some cases are also really the depository of record with that newspaper publisher. So further discussion through those partners has allowed us to also, it's very likely we're going to have copyright permission from the publishers, because they're seeing this as an opportunity for them to digitize their collections and keep them permanent, because they themselves, as very small publishers, don't have that opportunity for themselves, and they've already discovered that even some of the bigger microfilm outfits are not very interested in what they have to offer. So as I was gone for most of the summer doing a lot of traveling, but after I got back in July, on July 22nd, we got notification that we did receive our second TICFIA grant, so we will be launching what we're calling the Caribbean Newspaper Digital Library. Now, this is actually, it will still be folded within the DLOC database, but we're just, you know, we're giving it that name to concentrate on it. So that will be, we'll be working again with a initial small set of our partners in Haiti. This is where the University of Puerto Rico will be coming in, that we've been talking to them to include them, and National Library of Jamaica, among others. And then we're still, as we go into the 4 years, we'll be looking into and further discussing with other potential partners what we can do. I better quickly wrap up and just tell you too, it's been a fantastic project. It's one that's gotten my feet wet in the whole world of digital library creation. And I think it is a great model to look at in terms of what you can do with working with a wide group of partners, providing training for them, but also getting things back for yourself. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for coming out. I don't know if we're going to have time for questions. Unfortunately, it's 9 o'clock, and I think there is another presentation. There is a question. I guess you're right. It is at 9:30. So if anybody does have any present questions. Yeah, now we have sound. Let's listen to music. Yes.
That's a great question. Okay. Well, the question is, are we collaborating with any of the diaspora groups in the U.S.? Because, of course, they also publish materials, whether they're newspapers or other things. And within TICFIA, the whole point is collaboration. Again, with the name Foreign Information Access. So the emphasis really is on outside U.S. partners. Now, we have been actually working. There's a group in Miami that is trying to establish a Haitian Heritage Museum. So we are working with them more for community outreach, not so much to pull in their materials. But that it's certainly an idea that we could, because, again, we have a fair amount of elasticity with the budget, and the TICFIA office, you always have to call them and get permission to change budget items. They might say yes in certain circumstances, but it would probably have to be on a lesser scale, since the idea is that we really want the bulk of our activities and our budgets to be going out to the Caribbean. But it's an interesting idea to explore.
Well, that's great. That's okay. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming out. I really appreciate it.